This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. Shaking the world and seeing what falls. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio.
We are into the home stretch with Eric Mitchell. There's so much here to delve into, and we are not even scratching the surface. We're going to have you back, Eric, for a full 2 hours. But you were talking about your brain was emitting 1,000 hertz.
1,540, but that was 2014, the last time we recorded in Nashville. As a matter of fact, the guys in Nashville, they weren't too privy on doing the whole project, but the wife was an experiencer and she pushed for it. She said, you guys have to do this. And, you know, they were really skeptical. I don't blame them. I went into the soundproof room. They were looking at a 70-inch TV, and I was determined to show them that they shouldn't be skeptical. So I blasted, I think it was 741 hertz, pretty loudly, and they picked it up just fine. They were kind of upset at first. They were saying, no, check the diagnostics. That's not him. There's something wrong with the equipment. So they ran diagnostics, and they found out it was me. And, I mean, they just got really excited. So that kind of changed their mind a little bit, but yeah, it was 1,540 hertz that they determined that I was doing, which later on, in my obsession to try to figure out what this is, I thought I had turned over everything I could find to figure things out. And I was talking to a guy in MUFON not too long ago, and he said, well, can you achieve a radio wave? And I said, whoa, what? You know, radio wave, what do you mean? He goes, I think he said 1,548 hertz, which I was just shy of that in Nashville. And, you know, the implications of that just blew my mind. So my investigator and I, we've got to get together very soon with some different equipment and try some more experimentation.
So, I mean, if you're in this studio and you're producing this sound, I mean, without equipment, is it, if I was standing next to you, would I hear it?
Yeah, you'd have to kind of put your ear to my head, or a stethoscope works really well, or just an amplifier with a shirt mic. Usually when I show people, I have them put it on my head so it doesn't look like I'm trying to pull off any kind of trick or anything. That's usually what people do. They think, well, you're just wiggling the mic or something like that. And that's not the case, because before I had great control, now I can do five-dimensional frequencies, you know, the background all the way to the foreground with complete control, better control than my voice. So when people say, well, you're just kind of wiggling the mic, I said, well, hold it, you know, put it up to my head and have fun. You know, I understand skeptical thought. You know, I lived my whole life that way.
So this is how you suppose the grays, I'm guessing, are communicating with people telepathically. So now you're able to do it back, but are you, I mean, the sounds that you're creating, what is that, like the carrier wave? I mean, are you able to encode a message in that? Can you communicate telepathically?
Well, I don't understand. There were two messages, and every time I would mess up, it would interrupt me, and I'd repeat it again. So those are the ones that we did in Nashville. They're still being studied. They might be studied for God knows how long. I don't know. But they've only said in English one thing to me, and that was it. And I was leaning up against my apartment. I was alone. It was after dark, and it showed up at the end of the street. And I'm going, what are you? What is going on? You know, I had so many questions. My fear was starting to go away, and I was just overwhelmingly curious. You know, this thing just impacted my life, destroyed everything. You know, I want to know what is going on, you know, and all of a sudden, just right inside my mind, It was, to look is not to see. It is merely to observe with what little we have to offer. And I had no idea what that meant. And it really scared me to, you know, feel that type of communication, because it was emotional as well. It was psychic as well. It was almost, you know, the interconnectivity is unexplainable. But that's the only thing I've ever gotten English at all. It was, sorry about the shaky voice, but, you know, I kind of go back to it in my mind when I'm talking about it.
Right. I can't imagine. Yeah.
But, yeah, I've overcome a lot in a long time. But if it weren't for my investigator, I would have put that 380 in my mouth and you know, ended it right there a long time ago.
You were that close. I mean, it was in your lap. You were thinking about what you were sitting in your car, thinking about ending it right there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Craving it. I mean, wanting it more than anything in the world, because I couldn't handle it. I just, there was no way. And instead of most investigators, they come, they get your evidence, they take off and they go study it. And maybe someday they'll call you back and say, congratulations, that was real. But he really understands because he's been through it himself. So there were many nights where I was just breaking down and not able to handle what was going on. And you know, I have to say the worst part is being a father to children and not being able to protect them from something that you don't even understand. And I think that just destroyed me the most. You know, it's been a long, long journey in a very short period of time, but I still keep plugging along, you know.
And if this is ongoing. This is ongoing, right? And this is still happening. And how about with your children? How are they? I know they're in college, but how are they doing?
They're okay. They really are. I mean, my oldest daughter, she graduated high school at a very young age. She's 23 right now. She's going, you know, for a master's in biology. So my son, he's doing great. He's looking into engineering and stuff like that. Highly intelligent children, you know, they've grown with it. But I believe because they didn't have so much social conditioning thrown at them, and this happened to them at a younger age, they were more able to accept it than I was. And they were so calm about things where I just couldn't handle it, you know. And I really think that comes with having a forced thought process that gets put on us. You know, children, if a child sees a unicorn, they'll go, yay. But if you and I saw a unicorn, it's like, geez, get a picture. Nobody's going to believe this. So it's just a different mindset.
And how did you mentioned your investigator. Do you want to give us his name and say hello, or is that kind of a, I don't want to betray any confidences here.
No confidence. His name is Barry Gaunt. He's Kentucky's MUFON state director. He's been studying this for, like I said, over 40 years, 25 with the STAR team. Wonderful, wonderful soul. I mean, I owe my life to the man. And I did tell him that once. I said, you know, how could I ever repay you for what you've done for me? You know, my children, you've helped us out of the kindness of your heart, you know. And he said, one day when you get back on your feet and off your knees, he said, help people like yourself. He said, now you understand what it's like for them, you know, so be there for them. And I have ever since.
And how did he help you get up off your feet? How did he get you from the victim stage to acceptance, if that's a word that you use?
Well, he was just literally there anytime I needed him. You know, I use the analogy, say if you have to have your leg removed, you wake up after surgery, there's a nub there, you think, how am I ever going to live again? You know, and you can become an alcoholic, you can be a poor little me person for as long as you want to, you know, get scapegoats to tell you that drinking's okay and what you've been through is horrible and all that stuff. Or you can be choosing to imagine in your mind, 2 years from now, I'm going to be a marathon runner with the prostheses. Both of these two things are really possible. But the fact that he was there, just simply there, that's all, really helped me out quite a bit. And I've never been a fan of being a victim to anything. So, you know, I went after this. I had to. I mean, there's a lot of ufologists that have been doing this for 40 years. But because there's so many falsehoods and everything thrown in their face all the time, it takes them 40 years to get where I'm at now, you know, to understand so many different things. So I had more drive than most people to find out what this is all about. You know, it's not just a hobby for me. It's I've got scars all over my body, and there's no explanation for any of it.
Your story is truly one of the most remarkable experiencer stories I've ever encountered, and I want to thank you for spending a little bit of time, as I say, an invitation to come back, and we'll do 2 hours and really drill down deep. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Stay tuned. Rosemary Ellen Guiley is next with Tales of a Haunted Doll, another alien abduction story, and a cursed treasure hunter from Oak Island. You're listening to The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Sarin.
Live from Toronto, Canada, Earth, The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett on Zoomer Radio.
Thanks for inviting me into your home, long-haul truck, RV, camper, your parents' basement, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Rosemary Ellen Guiley is here with our monthly paranormal news roundup. And then, part one of her paranormal road trip, she's compiling a list of the best paranormal destinations across the United States, from Salem, Massachusetts, to Gettysburg and the Lemp Mansion in St. Louis. Rosemary Ellen Guiley is a best-selling author, researcher, and investigator in the paranormal, metaphysical, and related fields, including hauntings, psychic skills and protection, afterlife studies and spirit communication, cryptids, alien contact, and the interdimensional aspects of our extraordinary experiences. She has more than 65 books published on a wide range of topics, including 9 single-volume encyclopedias and reference works. Some of her recent books include UFOs and the ET Presence, Mysteries of the Afterlife, Haunted Hills and Hollows, Contact with the Dead, and Slips in Time and Space. Hey, Rosemary. Welcome back to The Conspiracy Show. How are you?
Well, Richard, it's always a pleasure to be on. I had a great trip to England this spring where I did some research on some paranormal hotspots and I got to hike to some sacred places. It was a splendid trip, and I'm very busy writing and editing right now.
I've been following your exploits on Facebook, and all I can say is I wish I had your frequent flyer points.
Well, they do pile up, and I do get a lot of free trips.
I'll bet. I'll bet. All right, so let's dive right in. And, you know, here's a story. When I first saw the headline, I thought, this is right up Rosemary's alley, because you've written about this, numerous books. We hear a lot about these haunted dolls. And here we have this 116-year-old doll in England that appears to have blinked. What can you tell me about this?
You know, Richard, I wish I could believe it, because the photograph really does look compelling. I don't think it's a hoax at all. I think that what we're looking at is a natural camera light effect. This doll, which goes back to 1903, and by the way, I have some problems with the backstory on the doll that I'll get into, but a couple of paranormal investigators are in possession of this doll, and they took it to a haunted location and took a selfie with the doll. Now, the doll has black holes for eyes, and they were astonished that one of the selfies that they took, the doll appeared to have blinked. That is, it appeared to have closed eyes with eyelashes on the bottom and even mascara on the lids. And, of course, this had quite a play on the Internet. However, if you look carefully at the doll, you can see that flash was used. And there's a shine on the doll's face, for example. And what they're saying are eyelashes at the bottom of the eyes. I think that's just part of the black hole of the two eye sockets, and that for whatever reason, and they have not been able to duplicate this photo, and they probably never would because the camera would have to flash at exactly the right angle, that the camera flashed and didn't capture the entire black eye sockets, but grayed out some of the upper portion of them. So it looks like the doll has closed eyes.
Ah, Well, you know, I think it's so important to have you on to debunk some of these cases, because it makes the ones that, you know, there's always that 1% or 5% or whatever it is that cannot be explained away by some prosaic explanation. Here's one that can. But as I said, you have written about haunted dolls before. You filled entire volumes of with haunted objects. And to this day, you know, the haunted doll, it continues to freak me out. Do you have a collection of haunted dolls?
I don't. And John, my colleague John Zaffis has dozens and dozens of them. And I've never been a doll collector, but there are a lot of dolls that do wind up being problematic in terms of spirit attachments and hauntings. And I would not want to own a collection of them for that very reason. Now, this particular doll, and there are a lot of dolls that have genuine issues with them. This particular doll, the investigators named Janet because it didn't have a name before that, but they used a ghost box around the doll and asked what the name was, and they got the name Janet. Now, the history goes back to 1903, but there's no explanation for how and why this doll became so haunted. But the story is that the family that owned the doll, everybody experienced problems around it. They got sick, dizzy, headaches, they didn't feel right around it. And strangely, and this is what puzzles me, the family kept the doll for generations. Now, you would think that if you were in possession of an object that you associated with ill health effects, you wouldn't keep it. You would get rid of it. So that's a problem in the story right there. And sometimes these haunted doll stories sort of get started with a little bit of folklore and they kind of grow like Topsy. And then you have people kind of chiming in through auto-suggestion. Supposedly, these current owners of the dolls, somebody owned it and begged them to take it from her. I don't know why people just didn't dispose of this thing. But at any rate, they own this doll now. And it could very well be that people feel ill effects around the doll, even though we don't know why. There's no tragedy. There's no supernatural activity. There's nothing to tell us anything as to why that should be the case. I suspect that a lot of the effects that people feel are auto-suggestion. For example, if you're a paranormal investigator and you're exposed to a famous haunted doll that's supposed to make people sick, well, you're probably going to be sick too, or think you are. So the whole story has a lot of holes in it for me.
Sure. And why is it, and I may be mistaken here, but I'm guessing that the dolls are one of the most popular haunted items. I mean, if there's an object that's going to be haunted, particularly an antique doll, why is that, do you suppose?
Well, one of the things that John Zaffis and I came to the conclusion on in Haunted by the Things You Love, where we talk a lot about haunted dolls, is that people develop emotional attachments to dolls, especially children, but even adults do. And because they are made in a human likeness, a lot of projection can be placed upon them, and emotional attachment. And so then if there's a tragedy in the family, especially someone who's been close to a doll, there can be residual energy that becomes attached to the doll. And in some cases, spirits do attach to dolls, too. They may even be drawn by the emotional bond that somebody might feel toward a doll. So this makes dolls kind of an ideal object for a haunting because they're replicas of human beings.
If you had to pick one case of a haunted doll that you found to be the most remarkable or frightening, what would that be? Does one jump immediately to mind?
Well, one of the ones that I became involved in, a case that I became involved in some years ago, is Harold the Haunted Doll. This has a legacy on the internet, some of which may be problematic, but it was associated with a lot of poltergeist phenomena, not just ill effects, but if somebody owned the doll, things would start happening in their homes. And I believe it's still owned by a gentleman now. I think he's down in Florida. Harold the Haunted Doll. One of the most famous, of course, is Annabelle. That's an Ed and Lorraine Warren case that they claimed the doll was demonically possessed, and that became the subject of a couple of movies.
Sure, sure. Listen, I want to ask you about this, the Pascagoula abduction case, which, quite honestly, I'm not that familiar with, but it has been heralded as one of the most famous abduction cases. This took place down in on the banks of the Pascagoula River in Mississippi back in 1973. And there were a couple of witnesses at that time who came forward. And one of them, you know, maintained until his death, I guess about 11 years ago, that it all happened. And now, apparently, 4.5 decades later, another witness has come forward. But for those, first of all, not familiar with Pascagoula, the abduction case, just give us a thumbnail sketch and then tell us about this new witness.
It's one of the most famous cases on record, abduction cases on record, and it's considered to be one of the most solid because the witnesses, the victims, stuck to their stories over the years. Charles Hickson and Calvin Parker Jr. were out night fishing, and they saw an object, a strange light in the sky that started descending. It turned into a craft and landed on the ground nearby, and these three scary-looking beings came out. They were about 5 feet tall. They had no eyes. They had slits for mouths. They were not grays. Hickson and Parker were paralyzed and floated in the ship and then subjected to terrifying medical examinations. A very, very traumatic case. And it was famous. I mean, it made world UFO news. And Hickson and Parker were on the lecture circuit for many years talking about their case. And most ufologists consider it to be one of the most solid on record. Well, Hickson's dead now. Parker's getting on in years. Parker, in fact, just came out with a new book, and he's back on the lecture circuit now talking about this. Well, interestingly, I mean, here we have this case in 73. No other witnesses came forward at that time to say they also saw a strange light in the sky or saw a craft come down. But now, all these years later, three other people have come forward and said, oh, yeah, we saw strange lights in the sky that night, and we think it was the one that that affected these guys. I find that a little odd that now it's not unusual for people to be quiet about UFO sightings. They fear ridicule or they're terrified. They're afraid it might happen again to them. So in one sense, it's not entirely implausible that people would not have come forward before. But we have to keep in mind that Parker's just fresh out on the lecture circuit again, and this case is getting a whole new renewed look, and now we have these other three witnesses who have come forward. Well, maybe they did see something strange in the sky, but we have no real solid evidence to connect it to what happened to Parker and Hickson.
Now, did the new witnesses, did they claim that they were taken aboard, or did they just claim that they saw something?
They just claimed that they saw something. They did not have abduction experiences. And one of them was out on a double date, and she said she saw some lights and wasn't sure what she was looking at because it was too far away, but it became closer, the people she were with freaked out when they saw it had a saucer shape. Another witness that said she noticed a blue light in the sky over about the area where Hickson and Parker said they were fishing. So this is not very strong circumstantial evidence. Sometimes in cases of sightings where there are multiple witnesses, there might be multiple lights or craft in the sky. It might not be just one. But why have they waited so long to speak up?
Right, right. Aside from the fact that Parker and Hickson, you know, didn't change their story and maintained it right till the end, and Parker, as you say, still does, what else makes this story so credible in your mind?
Well, mainly it was the credibility of the victims and the fact that they were, you know, considered to be sound people. This was not a hoax. They had no interest in UFOs. Interestingly, the descriptions that they gave of these entities really haven't been duplicated in other sightings. Now, before the Grays came to be kind of like the gold standard of ET contact, which I think is kind of a media-induced thing, when people drew illustrations of the alien beings that they saw, the descriptions were all over the place. And in fact, a lot of them were just one-offs, and that was the case with the Pascagoula as well. But the details of the medical examinations conform to what started coming out later. You know, it was in the 70s, and really not until the 80s that we started hearing a lot about abduction experiences.
Well, first hour of the program, I spoke with Eric Mitchell and his alien abduction. Are you familiar with the Eric Mitchell case?
I'm not.
Oh, my gosh. We had him on in hour one, and it's remarkable. But you and I, we can talk about it at some point. I don't want to bog things down now. But of all the abduction cases that I've listened to over the years, and I have not had an experience, his case is absolutely stunning. We'll talk about it sometime, and I'll have to have you back on to discuss it. I want to ask you about this professor at Cornell University in New York, who is an expert in early Christianity. And she believes she has identified the true identity of the Antichrist. What can you tell me about the work of Professor Kim Haynes Eidson?
I'm highly dubious about this. Now, she's associating Satan, the Antichrist, with details from the Book of Revelation, and that 666 is supposed to be the number of the beast. And she says that 666 is the number of the Roman Emperor Nero, who reigned in the AD 50s. And as you know, the famous story about him is he let the barbarians through the gates, you know, the iconic story about him is that he fiddled while Rome burned. I was definitely not well liked. And that the Book of Revelation may have been describing a political scenario rather than something religious. I'm surprised at this argument, because most scholars date the Book of Revelation to at least 30 to 40 years later than the Rome of rule of Nero. They feel that it was authored sometime during the rule of Domitian. And if that's the case, then why would they? The Book of Revelation is about prophecies to come, If it deals really with Nero, and it was written 30 to 40 years after the reign of Nero, why would they be right? Why would the author or authors, it's believed that John of Patmos was the author of this, why would that be writing about past history? And the fact that the number 666 is not consistent with the sign of the beast. The Bible also mentions the number 616. So I don't think it's a solid argument.
I mean, you managed to poke some pretty big holes. I don't know if this is her thesis, but, you know, good luck to her trying to defend it. I mean, the number 666, I mean, that could apply to so many people. I've heard so many different theories. Even some have suggested that Barack Obama, somehow you can break that name down to 666. I mean, do you have any thoughts on who, first of all, do you believe in an Antichrist, and any thoughts on who it might be?
My opinion of the Book of Revelation, and you know, I have to qualify that by saying I'm not a Book of Revelation scholar. I haven't done a lot of in-depth study on it, but of course I have researched it and read it in conjunction with some of the books I've written. I do believe that it is a religious vision, and that it deals with end times to come, and coming to terms with good and evil, and the ability of good to trounce evil. I don't think it has anything to do with earthly politics. I'm kind of surprised at this attempt to relate it to earthly politics.
Is there necessarily just one? People have described Adolf Hitler as an antichrist, Saddam Hussein as an antichrist. I mean, is it possible that there's more than one?
I think we could certainly make the case for that, that the Antichrist is evil personified, and it may not be just one individual. And the book of Revelation describes the beast as a dragon-like creature with seven heads and ten horns. And, of course, the serpent has, in Christian imagery, has been associated with the devil and Satan for a long time. But the Antichrist could definitely be any person who embodies evil and wreaks evil havoc upon the earth. Whether or not the book of Revelation was pointing to one Antichrist that was going to be like the mother of all evil individuals, nobody really knows.
But you do believe in demons, obviously, because you've written about it. But not necessarily when we're talking about demons, are you talking about the same demons that are described in the Bible, or do you think that there's something else entirely?
Well, there certainly is a demonic realm, and the demonic realm existed long before Christianity did. The belief that there were malevolent and hostile spirits afoot that were capable of wreaking havoc on the planet and with people. Some of them were just mischievous. Some of them were very hostile and aggressive. Christianity took that to a different level by associating the demonic realm with an army of evil beings organized under Satan, the chief adversary. Satan, of course, in Hebrew lore was a job description, not necessarily the arch fiend of all evil. Demons now are all, in the Christian view, are all organized under Satan, and their purpose is to subvert souls and get people condemned to hell. Whereas in the ancient view, and in other views still in play on the planet today, the demonic realm it's a problem realm. It's like the neighborhood bad guys. And you got to be careful. You got to watch out. You don't want to run afoul of them. And there are various remedies that can be taken when you do. Very different viewpoints.
All right, Rosemary, we're going to take a quick time out. When we come back, we'll continue on with our paranormal news roundup, and we'll head down to Alabama to talk about the legend of the White Fang. Back with more of The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us.
Don't be afraid of the dark. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio. To talk to Richard, call 416-360-0740 or toll free 1-866-740-4740.
Welcome back. Rosemary Ellen Guiley is here for her regular monthly visit. Her website, visionaryliving.com. Last night on Coast to Coast, I had Lyle Blackburn on, and we were talking about Momo, the Missouri monster. And I was vaguely familiar with Momo, but I'm not familiar at all with Alabama's legend of the White Fang. Fang as in T-H-A-N-G. What can you tell me about this creature?
A little Alabama accent twist there. Well, actually, there are a lot of white things around. And this particular one in Alabama, there may be different versions of white things, but this particular one in Alabama is described as what might be an albino Bigfoot. And there have been other cases, sightings of albino Bigfoot creatures, and of course the abominable snowman of Eurasia would be all shaggy white hair. This particular creature has especially been spotted in northern Alabama. It's kind of skinnier than a lot of big other Bigfoot creatures seen around, which stands to reason there may be more than, you know, Bigfoot exists, and I believe Bigfoot does. There may be multiple types of Bigfoot. skeptics have said, oh, it's just an albino bear. I don't know what an albino bear would be doing in Alabama, but I guess the skeptics come up with whatever they can. Now, I first heard of white things when I was researching creatures in West Virginia, and this is a variation of the same thing. The white things there, and I also found stories about them in Kentucky and Tennessee and the surrounding areas. This creature was similar, except it went on all fours, but it had shaggy white hair. It has shaggy white hair and huge fangs, and is described as a cross between a bear and a lion and about as big as a cow. And it attacks people who are out in the woods. As far as we know, the Alabama white fang hasn't really attacked people, but these other white things will come upon hikers and hunters and campers and rush at them, roaring away like it's going to tear them to pieces with its huge fangs, and it'll go right through them. They're not harmed at all. And these creatures have been seen and documented since the early 20th century in the backwoods. So there may be variations of the white thing out there. And in Alabama, we find it as the white fang, which looks more like a Bigfoot.
Hmm. So the white fang in Alabama, I mean, if it's an albino Sasquatch or an albino Bigfoot, I'm not sure what percentage of the population are albinos. It's very small. That would tend to suggest, I mean, if you had this mutation, that there'd have to be a fairly large population of Bigfoots in order for an albino to come along, don't you think?
Well, you could certainly make that argument. And this is one of the conundrums we run into in Bigfoot research is how many of them are out there. Because not many of them are seen at any given time. And this leads to a lot of arguments as to whether or not they're flesh and blood creatures or something that slips in and out of some sort of parallel dimension. But I don't know. Scientifically, there must be some statistics out there that would predict in any given animal population what an albino, what percentage would be an albino mutation. I would think it would be very small.
And the fact that it's white, that should be standing out like a sore thumb. We have albino moose up here in Canada. And, lots of pictures taken of it because you're not going to miss that. But an albino Sasquatch in Alabama, and they don't get snow in the winter, I don't imagine. I mean, it's not going to be very easy for this creature to hide. Are there photographs of it? Do we know?
I have never seen an alleged photograph. There have been eyewitness reports. Even the brown and the reddish brown Bigfoot, which are far more common, photographs of them are very sketchy at the best.
Yes, I remember the late great comedian Bill Hicks, who once theorized that maybe Bigfoot was born blurry. I want to talk to you about Oak Island, off the coast of Nova Scotia, up here in Canada. Of course, one of our most famous legends, and interesting story here about the tragic life of an Oak Island treasure hunter by the name of Jim Kaiser. Tell me about Jim.
Well, his story is tied into the overall arching story of the Curse of Oak Island, which is the subject of a very popular cable show now, and I have enjoyed it immensely. Just a bit of background. Supposedly, there's a huge amount of money buried somewhere on this island off Nova Scotia, and the exact location has been referred to as the Money Pit. And for, a couple of centuries now, treasure hunters have scoured and dug on the island searching for the Money Pit. And some of them have met a very sad demise. And that's exactly what happened to Jim Kaiser. Now, supposedly, there's a curse on this money. And six treasure hunters have died trying to find the treasure. The curse says seven must die before it can be found. The whole island is supposed to be haunted. People experience weird orbs, moving orbs, phantoms, apparitions. People who've tried to treasure hunt there have mysterious equipment breakdowns. Bad things happen to them. And that gets us back to the story of Jim Keyser. He was a very good friend of the Restall family, who, father and son, and they employed a crew, and they were busy digging away, trying to get at the money pit. And tragedy befell them. Robert Restall apparently breathed some poisonous gas in one of the shafts and fell into the shaft. And his son tried to rescue him. The same thing happened to him and two other workers after that. So four men died. And Jim Keyser was, he was not present when this happened. He was part of the digging crew, but he was not present. He was extremely upset, and he was the one who went and recovered the bodies. He put on a gas mask, went down and recovered all the bodies, and he was never the same after that. He was mentally off. As you can imagine, the trauma of that.
Right.
He started drinking heavily, had run-ins with the law. One night he went and stayed in the cabin that the Restalls had used, and he was awakened in the middle of the night by this huge, hairy, almost sounds like a Bigfoot kind of beast, that grabbed a hold of him. It had red eyes, and he said it was covered with a black hair that looked very tightly coiled, which is different from other Bigfoot descriptions, because most Bigfoot descriptions are loose, shaggy hair. But this beast spoke to him, we don't know whether it was verbally or mentally, and said that he should never come back. And he was so shaken by this experience. He had bruises on his arms after that. This was not a dream. He was so shaken after that, that's exactly what he did. He did not go back. And nobody believed him. You know, he tried to tell a story, and nobody would believe him, and that frustrated him. Well, he eventually then took another job as the site passed on to other owners who were digging. He was never right. He was still never right after that, and he wound up committing suicide by shooting himself. And so he became the sixth victim of the Curse of Oak Island.
Remarkable, remarkable. I wasn't familiar with that aspect of the story. Now, I met one of the daughters of the Restall family. She had recently been married when her parents, who actually I believe met, they were circus performers or motorcycle daredevils who met in Europe. And if I'm remembering the story correctly, and then they decided to give up everything and move out to Oak Island, and were kind of living in trailers out there. And she had some home movies she showed me of her father and brother, and what life was like out there on the island. But she never mentioned the Jim Keyser story. Absolutely remarkable. Listen. Speaking of Oak Island, have you been?
I've never been there, and I would love to visit it, mainly because of the lore. Here's my feeling about the treasure hunting there. And, you know, this show has been quite popular for a number of seasons now. But if there's such a horrible curse on this money, no good can come of it by finding it. And I think it should be well enough left alone.
I agree. And the other thing is, so many people have excavated and dug other tunnels and things. You know, I think because it's sand down there, I don't think they'll ever be able to retrieve it anyway. I think it's probably all collapsed in on itself because there's been too much digging and drilling and so forth. But you've never been. Maybe it's something you should put on your list. And when we come back, why don't we sort of compile a paranormal road trip, top destinations, if someone wants to jump in their car this summer and hit all the paranormal hotspots across North America. Would you be good for that?
I would. There's so many of them. It was really tough to pick a few, but I did.
All right. We'll do that when we come back. Rosemary Ellen Guiley, visionaryliving.com, the website. Back in a moment.
Strap yourself in. You're about to leave everything you thought you knew behind. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
All right, we are about to embark on a paranormal road trip across the United States. So, if you were to jump in the car, Rosemary, where would the first stop, a paranormal highlight in the United States?
Well, we can start east and go west, and I tried to pick a few spots scattered around, and very first one, I picked the entire town of Salem, Massachusetts, and this is an absolute must for anyone who wants to be in one of the most haunted locations in the country. I've spent quite a bit of time in Salem. Most of the hauntings there are tied to the witch hysteria of 1692. Where 200 people were accused of witchcraft, many died in jail, 19 people were executed, 18 by hanging, and one being crushed to death. And it's a tragedy that just has nightmarish aspects to it, and it has affected the entire town. Now, the really cool thing about Salem is that the most haunted parts of it are in the central part of town that you can cover on foot. So if you drive there and park centrally or you stay in one of the central lodging places, you can hit all kinds of haunted places just over a weekend.
You spend Halloween there often, don't you?
I do. I go up every year, and I do a Black Mirror event for contacting the dead, and I stay for the witches' balls, and sometimes I stay for Halloween. It depends on when the other activities are scheduled as well. But Salem is like, Halloween in Salem is like Mardi Gras. It's just mobbed with people in costume. But just a quick sketch of the history here. Salem was founded by Puritans who landed at Plymouth and got upset with the fact that things were not strict enough in Plymouth, if you can believe it. The Plymouth Brethren fled England because of the oppression they were under, and when they came to America, they set up a regime that was even more oppressive than the one they left. And then a fraction of them split off because they wanted more oppression. So they sail around until they find this location, which becomes Salem, even though the Indians told them not to settle there. They said the land was cursed. We don't know why it was cursed. Native Americans just felt it was bad energy. But now the Puritans settle there anyway, and it's never a happy place. They had laws on the books against wearing colored clothing, against celebrating Christmas. You had to be in church every Sunday. You couldn't display affection in public. It was extremely repressive, a lot of jealousies, a lot of infighting. And it all erupted in 1692 when accusations of witchcraft started flying around. Now, there was Salem Town and Salem Village. Salem Town eventually became what's known as Danvers today. And there was a lot of rivalry between these two places. Well, it all started with children of Reverend Samuel Parrish. His daughter and her cousin and some friends were being taught and entertained with occult lore by his Barbados slaves, Tituba and John. It was mostly Tituba. And she was teaching them how to divine, and every girl wants to know what her husband is. It all gets out of hand. The girls start getting hysterical. They start having fits. They claim that the spirits of witches are after them. Now, mind you, the temper of the times was there were preachers like Cotton Mather roaming the countryside preaching against witches and the devil, and that these were a real danger to every community. So it all gets very out of hand, and the girls start accusing people of being witches who are persecuting them. And these people are actually arrested. The stories are believed. So accusations are made against dozens of people over the course of time, 200 in all. Trials are held where the testimony called spectral evidence of the girls is believed. Their stories are believed against the protestations of the innocent, and people are condemned to death. 18 people are hanged, a man is crushed to death, families are ruined, fortunes are lost, and it has left a heavy, heavy haunting residue in Salem and Danvers today. So if you walk around the central part, the old part of Salem, almost every building has something going on in it, haunting activity-wise. Now, underneath Essex Street, the main street in town, is a honeycomb of tunnels. And these tunnels were actually constructed so that goods could be moved in and out of the storefronts very easily. And the tunnels are all haunted. Stores are haunted. The museums are haunted. The old burial ground is haunted. Everywhere you go, you are confronted with the residual ghosts of Salem. I'll name a couple of my favorites. One is the Turner Seafood Restaurant, very popular place, built on the grounds of the old tavern owned by Bridget Bishop, and she was one of the first to be executed. Bridget was a social misfit. She dressed in colors. This was against the rules. She ran a tavern. It was said that she allowed people to gamble and play cards and drink after hours. So people wanted to get rid of her. Her ghost haunts that restaurant. The witch house owned by one of the old judges is haunted as well. The trials were not held there, but activity seems to have moved into the house because he was one of the main judges who condemned people to death. So well worth a visit, just a short drive from Salem.
Ah, all right. We'll come back and continue with our paranormal road trip with Rosemary Ellen Guiley. Stay with us.
The truth is not out there. It's right here. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett from Zoomer Radio.
And we are back with Rosemary Ellen Guiley, our paranormal investigator, researcher, best-selling author. And we're conducting a kind of a virtual road trip, paranormal road trip across America. We're going east to west. We started with Salem, Massachusetts. Where's the next stop, Rosemary?
Well, moving westward, we'd have to hit Gettysburg, which is probably the number one haunted location in America. It was the turning point of the Civil War, where the tide turned in favor of the North. It was fought over July 1st through the 3rd in 1863. 50,000 casualties, wounded and killed. The entire town of Gettysburg was affected. It was a huge battlefield that's now a historic site. And the battlefield is loaded with phenomena. I spent a lot of time at Gettysburg. It's residual. People hear gunfire. They smell smoke, gun smoke. They hear horses. They hear voices. They hear screams and fighting, cannons going off. And especially at some of the places where the most intense battles occurred. So a lot of paranormal investigation goes on at Gettysburg, and sometimes it can be done on into the evening. The park technically closes at dusk. In the summertime, you've got a few extra hours there in the evening to do investigations. People have captured interesting photos. They've gotten really amazing EVPs there. The town itself also was afflicted because sharpshooters moved into the town. A lot of civilians didn't flee. They just holed up in their homes. And many of the buildings in town have bullet holes in them or even unexploded mortars. Just about every farmhouse in the area was turned into a military headquarter or makeshift hospital. They're all haunted. They were turned into surgeries where soldiers had amputations, where lives were lost, bloodstains that are still on the floors. The lodging establishments in town are haunted. One of the most famous is the Farnsworth House, which has unexploded mortar in its walls. And a lot of the rooms have apparitions and what we call residual phenomena, which would be poltergeist effects and strange movements of objects. There also are apparitions of people in period clothing, some of them civilians. I even captured a photograph myself some years ago at one of the farmhouses that's now a bed and breakfast. And it's unknown whether these people were there during the actual fighting or whether they were just of that era. But Gettysburg became a town of tragedy. And like other places afflicted by tragedy, people, including Salem, people lost their fortunes, their lives, their livelihoods. They became destitute. And those effects linger today. So Gettysburg is well worth a stop.
All right. So moving further west, we've gone from Massachusetts down to Pennsylvania. Where's our next stop on our paranormal road trip?
It's St. Louis. And I picked the Lemp Mansion because Not a lot of people know about the Lemp Mansion, but it's considered to be one of the most haunted houses in America. And this belonged to the family of a German brewing magnate. German immigrants came over in the 1800s and settled there. The patriarch set up a small brewery for German lager. It became very successful. And when he died, his son William Lemp inherited it. And he built it up into the largest brewery in the world. No one's heard of Lemp today, of course, because it no longer exists. But back in the day, it was the largest brewery in the world. Now, when William Lemp married, and he married a wealthy woman, his father-in-law gave him this four-story mansion as a wedding present. Wouldn't we all love to have a father-in-law like that? And the Lemps lived very well and lavishly, and they had seven children. Now, the oldest son was earmarked to take over the family business, but at age 28, he suffered a fatal heart attack, and William Lemp never, ever recovered from that. In fact, one day he went downstairs to his marble office and shot himself through the heart and committed suicide. So the family business then passed to the next son, who was married to a spendthrift. Her name was Lillian. She was called the Lavender Lady, and her ghost haunts the place today. She liked lilac-colored clothing. And they wasted a lot of money. Now, for some reason, William Lemp Jr. also became quite despondent and did exactly what his father did. He went downstairs to the same office, shot himself through the heart, and committed suicide.
Dear. Oh, my.
One of the sisters committed suicide, not on the property, but she, too, died by her own hand. Now, the family fortunes were then thoroughly wrecked when Prohibition came along in 1919, and the breweries and distilleries were forced to adapt to other kinds of businesses. A lot of the breweries went into what was called near beer, and they started making stuff like ice cream and other things. But Lemp was never able to adapt, and so the family fortunes continued to spin into a decline. And William Jr. wound up selling the business in 1922 for a fraction of its value.
And
now, there was another tragedy on site.
Dear.
Another sibling, 1949. This guy was a little off in the head. And his name was Charles. And he went downstairs into the basement one morning with his dog, shot the dog to death, and then shot himself to death. So Lemp Mansion has a lot of violent history behind it, and it is very, very haunted. It's a historic place. You can take tours there today. There are groups that arrange ghost hunts. People who have done ghost hunts overnight have had all kinds of creepy things happen to them. Lillian's ghost wafts around the halls. Some of the heaviest and creepiest phenomena, as you can imagine, are down in the office where the two Williams shot themselves to death. The phenomena is still very, very strong today.
Have you had experiences at Lemp House?
I actually have. Yes, I've been to Lemp. And I've done some investigation there. It is true that where the suicides took place in the marble office, there's a very heavy, oppressive atmosphere, and you feel watched, you just kind of want to get out of the place because it is so oppressive. I've gotten EVPs there, very unusual EVPs. I did not see Lillian's ghost while I was there, but I have talked to other investigators who have seen her in her lilac clothing walking around the hallways.
Oh, my. Makes you wonder, what the heck were they putting in that beer? I mean, for such tragedy.
Well, I know. And then for so many suicides, it's really amazing. What was going on there with the family? I mean, who knows? We really don't know if some kind of mental illness ran in the family.
Has anyone tried to exorcise that house?
Not to my knowledge. And there would probably be a lot of angry ghost hunters if somebody tried.
That's true. That's true. Listen, we're gonna have to end the paranormal road trip there. We'll call this the end of part one. And next month when we have you back on, we'll do part two. and we'll continue to head further west on this paranormal road trip. But for now, people can start in Massachusetts and Salem, head on down to Pennsylvania and Gettysburg, and then to the gateway to the west, St. Louis and the Lemp Mansion. Rosemary, thank you so much for this. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure, too, Richard. Thank you.
And again, the website, visionaryliving.com. That's it for us. Back next week with a brand new program. In the meantime, don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that won't be revealed, and nothing hidden that won't be made known. What you hear in the dark, speak in the light. What I say in a whisper, proclaim from the housetops. Move over, Aphrodite. I'm coming home. Good night.
Canada, The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler. Hang your cloak on a peg. Grab a stool and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. If you're new to the program, welcome, and you've picked the perfect night to join us. Rosemary Ellen Guiley is an extraordinary paranormal researcher and the author of over 70 books, and she joins us in the second hour for a conspiracy show tradition. Once a month, she drops by, and we kick around a few wonderfully strange stories in the news. We call it the Paranormal News Roundup. This hour, in my 20-plus years behind a microphone, I've interviewed and met countless alleged alien abductees and UFO ET experiencers. But Eric Mitchell is, to date, the most credible such person I've met, and he has one of the most compelling stories. Eric has been counseling abductees of alien encounters for the last 5 years, since having his own encounter and facing the harsh reality of this phenomena and its effects on one's life. He's dedicated his time to helping others who have had the misfortune of experiencing this phenomenon firsthand. Along with educating the public and ufologists on this subject, Eric is a highly sought-after speaker and lecturer on the topics of UFOs at conferences and on radio, TV, and documentary films. Eric Mitchell, welcome to The Conspiracy Show. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on.
We should point out that you're down in Arkansas. Now, you grew up in a small town. You've described that as the Bible Belt. What, just before we get into your case, just tell me about life in small town Arkansas growing up.
Well, it's, you know, everybody knows everybody. You know, if something significant happens in your life, it travels around pretty fast. Very, very nice, kind, genuine people. You know, if you go to the grocery store and you have a little chit chat with the lady behind the counter, she genuinely wants to know how your day is. It's not a programmed response or a mechanical reactive behavior. You know, it's genuine people. What I went through, it made it very difficult to kind of stay around per se.
And you were a debunker on this subject for years, right? I mean, were you a regular churchgoer, and I mean, were you raised to, I guess, not believe in UFOs, aliens?
Well, of course, I think through social conditioning, especially here in America, that we're all raised not to believe in this kind of thing. I wasn't really actively a debunker. I wouldn't go after people for talking about that kind of thing, but I would shy away from them. Like, wow, this guy, you know, this guy's nuts. He's talking about UFOs. You know, I would definitely shy away from that kind of thing. I'd like to think that I was very simple Southern man, very practical, and slow, to be honest with you. I didn't really have a whole lot of intelligence, and this whole situation really changed my way of thinking 100%.
But for you, you know, that old expression, seeing is believing. But for you, in the beginning, seeing wasn't believing, correct?
That is correct. That is correct. I couldn't, you know, I'm a student of psychology. And when you come across something that's not supposed to be real, naturally you go that direction. And for me, I wanted to believe that I was suffering too much stress in my life. Maybe I was having some sort of delusion. You know, and it got really bad. It got to the point where I was daydreaming that I can go to a psychologist, get on medication. 6 months later, all this would be gone. Meanwhile, at the time, I'm having witnesses all over my neighborhood point these objects out. They're really scared. I had pictures and videos on my phone, very up close, very good pictures. And at the same time, I'm still telling myself, this isn't real. Everyone just noticed that I lost my mind. And they were agreeing with me just to be nice. You know, I was trying to paint that. And if I ever was delusional in my entire life, that would have been that time, because I could not accept it at all. It just wouldn't be a part of my reality.
So give us a time frame, and then we'll go through this kind of chronologically. When did the sightings? It was this orange spherical object floating around your place. When did that start?
I believe it was July 28th of 2013. I had woken up and I was standing outside of my apartment. I had no idea how I got there. And I kind of slowly woke up. I didn't wake up and just kind of jolt. You know, I slowly woke up with this confusion, like, what the hell am I doing outside? You know, and you know, I could feel my eyebrows just pushing together in confusion. And I'm looking at the dead end of the road. It's a very, very small street, very short dead end. And here this thing is. And my first thought is that an exploded transformer? But the more I became conscious, the more I was just absolutely confused. I'm looking at this bright light. It's maybe 35, 40 feet in diameter, and it looks like a miniature sun. And it didn't, what bothered me the most is it didn't really illuminate light. It was very bright, but the street, the apartments, the trees, everything around this thing was not illuminated, but it was extremely bright. So it really bothered my thinking.
And what time of day was that again?
It was around 4 a.m. I remember going inside, and it was about 4:18 when I walked inside and, turned on the television. I thought maybe there was some strange weather phenomena. I was kind of desperate at the time to try to figure out what the heck was going on. But I kept the door open all morning so I can kind of lean over on my couch and look out. And as soon as the doubt would come back into my mind, I would lean over and look and go, what the hell is that thing? You know, what could it possibly, you know, it didn't bob, it didn't weave, it just kind of marbled like water. Or if you were looking directly at the sun, it had that, that wavy motion to the, exterior. So, I figured by 6 a.m. or so, the sunlight would be out and I'd be able to, laugh at myself and go, look, you know, optical illusion. And, you know, the world would start spinning my way again. By the time the sun came up, I was getting the kids up and getting coffee and poked my head out as soon as the light came out, and there was nothing there. So I walked outside. I looked around to kind of give myself an idea of what caused this optical illusion, and I couldn't really explain it away. So, you know, that day I'm normally the guy with charisma at work and getting everybody going, but that day I was just really quiet, kept to myself, and really confused about what it was.
And you mentioned you're getting your kids breakfast. Did you discuss it with their mother, or did you just say nothing to no one?
Well, no, I was a single father at the time. And I really didn't want to say anything to the kids or anything like that. When you see something you can't explain, the last thing that you do is try to tell someone about it, at least in my situation, because, you know, if you see something that's not supposed to be real, you know, how do you even begin having that conversation? And that's what I find in my work, is that people internalize this so much that it literally just destroys them from the inside out. And it just takes one person to listen to and say, look, you're not crazy. I've witnessed these things too. And, you know, immediately their life gets a lot better. But that's what I did. I just internalized it, put it in the confusion folder in my mind, and tried to go on and have a normal day.
But obviously that wasn't the end of it. I mean, it kept coming back. And at some point, though, you had neighbors who saw it, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think there were 19 witnesses that literally lived on the street. But there was quite a few more, because people would talk at the grocery stores, you know, they'd talk at church, and they'd get curious about what's happening. They'd hear about this kind of thing, so they would drive up at night, and it became quite a bit of a fiasco, because people were throwing beer cans down, cigarette butts. There'd be 10, 20, 30 people outside of my apartment after dark, just to see what all the fuss is about. And so these people witnessed it too, went to other people, and word got around really fast. And because I live in the Bible Belt, they were saying that I was calling down the devil, you know, that I was in league with the devil somehow or something like that. So things got pretty negative, you know, for me in the town that I live in.
Why did they focus the attention on you just because it appeared outside your apartment? You had neighbors. Why you?
Well, it was obvious to everyone in the neighborhood that this thing was interested in me. If I'd walk away from the crowd, it would literally go across the street and be in front of me. So, and it really wouldn't show up until I came right outside. You know, people would knock on my glass. They would knock on my door. These are people I've never even met. You know, they just want to see the object. And I would come out and the object would show up. So, it really frightened a lot of people, including myself. I was physically affected by this thing, and affected in so many ways. I don't think we have enough time on the show to really get into all of that, but this object did hover above me. I was unaware of it. I was standing on my own shoelace at the time. And I kind of stepped back and untied my shoe. I'm sure everybody's done it once in their life. And I felt this vibration on the top of my head. And I didn't know what it was. I hurry up, you know, finish tying my shoe. And all of a sudden, it was like someone turned up the volume on this thing. It felt like a extremely unexplainable vibration and frequency. Kind of like if you're standing in front of a rock speaker during a conference or something like that, you know, you're going to feel the vibration come through. But this is maybe times a million. I went straight to the ground face first. I felt it mainly in my head. The only real thought I could push through my mind was, oh my God, I'm being killed. You know, it was that harsh. I did throw up, but the only reason I knew that is because my throat was open for a long period of time. And as soon as I could push myself off the ground and look up at the object, it flashed twice and darted away as fast as a bullet. No sound, no indication or anything. It was just jaw-dropping that there's no sonic boom. There's no anything like that, but it just took off. So I kind of laid there.
And you were bleeding, right? You were bleeding out of your nose and your ears?
Yes, my left ear and both nostrils and my nose. I actually, I literally crawled into the apartment, got into the, you know, the bathroom floor, and I was so hot. My skin was like sunburned. I felt like I had third degree burns on my brain. Literally, it was just on fire. And, you know, we don't have nerve endings on our brain to literally feel something like that. So I'm still confused about that. But I just laid on that cold floor and passed out. I did yell to my kids, call 911, but I think they were already sleeping.
You know, as I'm hearing this, particularly, you know, the witnesses that saw this orange sphere floating above your neighborhood, the image that came into my mind was the Fatima apparition of 1917. Are you familiar with that case?
I don't think so.
Portuguese children, very poor Portuguese children in Fatima, Portugal, village during the First World War, saw what they believed was the apparition of the Virgin Mary, and she visited with them and revealed all of these, you know, prophecies and so forth. And then at some point there were thousands of people who came because it was a recurring occurring episode, and they saw this light in the sky. It was sort of, you know, dancing in the sky and things. And this was, you know, seen by thousands of people. And so I'm, you know, the fact that you had all of these witnesses, I'm surprised it didn't garner the kind of media attention that, I mean, the Fatima apparition is, particularly among observant Catholics, is, you know, is a huge event. And yet your event, I'm guessing, didn't receive that kind of media attention.
Well, it actually did. I got a call from a CNN reporter, several different news outlets, all kinds of things. You know, it did get out. But I was in a position where the only way I could actually explain it is when I went through my divorce. You know, I had constant anxiety. What's going to happen to the kids? What's going to happen to my home? Is my bank account going to get drawn in? So I was in that state of constant fear and worry and confusion. I was definitely not in a position to go sit down in front of CNN and tell them what happened. I mean, today, yeah, I could do that. But back then, my worldview was absolutely 100% being destroyed. You know, everything that I believed in, everything that I was changing. And it's, you know, I was suffering from what you would call maybe savant syndrome, where you have a very low IQ and the next thing you know, it's 150 and you don't know what to do with that. You know, so I was going through a lot of struggles with these things, and there was no way in the world I was going to be that crazy UFO guy that everybody laughs at, you know, for a split second on television. I'd like to think of myself a little more aware than that. You know what I mean? It's just, I just didn't want to be in that situation, especially being a single father, four kids, and you don't want DHS banging on your door going, hey, you're nuts. You know, I'm going to take your children away now. So, there's so many factors that you can put into that, but you know, now that the kids are all off to college, you know, I can talk about these things, you know, especially not just for myself, because I speak to at least one new person every day that has these experiences, maybe not 100% the same, but very, very similar. And it just keeps coming out over and over and over again. And it's just jaw-dropping to hear from 125 different countries all over the world with people telling you, yes, I've seen this thing. Oh my God, I'm not crazy. So it really helps them out. You know, they don't have a voice. I don't think most of them ever will until this taboo really lifts, you know, from our society and becomes something a little more understanding about this. You know, the CIA, they're completely involved with studying this kind of thing. Yet us people think, you know, it's all taboo and it's all quote unquote crazy.
When did you notice the birds flying into your building and killing themselves?
Oh, that was just before the first UFO incident. I actually recently spoken with a man about, I think, 20 minutes from here, and he's been trying to find me. He tracked me down. He said, you know, that same night, those birds, I saw an object floating over the trees, and it was the same as I described, and these birds are just falling down dead right there in his driveway. And he thought he was alone for the longest time with seeing this object, but he wasn't, you know, and we've been talking quite a bit about it.
And at some point, because of the birds, I guess, you had the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, came to your place knocking on your door. What were they looking for?
Well, The first thing I asked them, because they were in full gear, you know, am I in danger? Are my kids in danger? Because, you know, I was laying on the couch. I was trying to get a nap. Single parents never get naps, so this was like a great thing for me. And I hear just rocks or baseball or something just hitting the side of the building. So I'm thinking, you know, kids are playing baseball or something like that outside. But once it got so loud and so frequent, I decided I was going to go out and scold some children for being so loud and damaging to my apartment. And, well, that wasn't the case at all. It was these black birds. They were literally falling from the sky and landing into the end of my apartment. The CDC asked me if I had any strange electrical things in the house, you know, and I told them, no, I have a refrigerator, television, you know, just normal stuff, you know, I don't have any strange electrical anything, you know. And I asked them if I was going to get some kind of, you know, information about what was going on, because, you know, there could be some kind of flu, there could be, you know, disease or something like that. And I literally, I've never heard back from them. As a matter of fact, I saw it a couple of nights later. It was on national news that all these birds were falling out of the sky, and there was no explanation other than fireworks is the only thing they can come up with.
You mentioned your IQ went from 110 to 150. So you had yourself tested, right? What sort of came into your mind that you realized, I need to get this tested because I'm not the old me anymore?
Well, I was really lucky. I was looking for someone in the very beginning that knew about this. I didn't care if it was paranormal, explainable. I didn't care. I just wanted to talk to someone that knew about this kind of thing and literally just open my mouth and say these things so I can get them off my chest. You know, they were boiling inside. I needed to erupt. I needed to speak with someone. And I found a man that was with MUFON for the longest time. He's been studying this thing on his own for over 40 years, you know. So I got on the phone with him, and the first 2 minutes, I'm rolling my eyes going, this guy's crazy. You know, he's talking about UFOs and aliens and all this stuff. And but I decided I was going to stay on the phone and listen to everything the man had to say. So I was lucky to have him, because in the beginning, he started a case. He started collecting evidence, witness statements, and all that stuff. So it was just really good I was so lucky to run in him to him at that time.
But did you, was there a sort of an aha moment for you when you said, I think I'm a lot smarter than I used to be? What's going on here?
Well, he noticed the change, you know. I noticed the change as well, but he noticed it. He said, you know, you're talking faster. You know, what's going on with this? And during these investigations, you want to do psychological analysis every 3 months. If you notice anything at all, you need to follow it, you know, and document it. And for me, it was almost instantaneous, but not at the same time. I would notice my thoughts, thinking, for a small example, I went to a pep rally to see my son, you know, play his horn, have a good time, root for our team. I've done it for years, you know, and I walk up to the school, and this school I've known for years, and it's called Cutter Morning Star. People can Google it. It's in Hot Springs, Arkansas. I went, Morning Star, you know. So everything that I had initially looked at throughout my life had changed in front of my eyes. So I'm walking around seeing
Eric,
things.
Pardon the interruption. I'm going to take it. Sure. This will be a bit of a cliffhanger. We'll come back and we'll pick up on this story. Eric Mitchell, experiencer, abductee, back with more of The Conspiracy Show in a moment. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett from Zoomer Radio.
Eric Mitchell stays with us. Just a reminder, coming up in the second hour, Rosemary Ellen Guiley with our paranormal news roundup. And she'll also take us on a little paranormal road trip across America and highlight some of the top places. So, Eric, you were talking about this aha moment when you realized that you had received sort of a significant upgrade, shall we say. You went to a pep rally at your son's public school, and the name of the school, Morning Star, something clicked.
Yes. I never thought about that before. But I went into the pep rally, And I'm looking at kids holding flags with goats on them. I'm looking at young ladies with painted faces, short skirts, throwing their legs in the air in front of the crowd. I'm looking at children, you know, chanting, fight, 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 win, 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 you know, a practice of dislike or hatred toward a town because of a ball game. And, you know, I started thinking about divide and conquer, and I started thinking about the thought process of one town versus another and what we teach our children. And, you know, I started thinking about different counties, different towns. You know, accents divide us, religion divides us, you know, and if you look at the United States, it's not the United States, it's the divided states, because look at all those lines and different names. So I just kind of went through all of that in my mind so fast, and I went, wow, what the hell? You know, I'm just a simple redneck, and here I am just having all these thoughts and emotions and feelings. And that, too, was really, really difficult to handle. I mean, it got to the point where I had to keep my mind busy. I had to keep reading. You know, I got into mathematics and botany, and this was not me. This was not how I normally am, you know. Get up, go to work, take care of the kids, do my routine, because routine is safe for a single parent. And here I am divulging. Like, the only way I can explain it with addiction is cigarettes, because I smoke. And so if I want one really bad, I know that feeling. And I was just craving so much information. And to this day, I literally haven't read one book on the UFO subject. And I think that's kept me safe for a lot of reasons. I just couldn't get enough information. And now I think I'm definitely full of useless information, I had to learn. I just had to keep cramming. It was just an impulse to keep going. And it was mind-wrecking. It was very, very, very difficult to per se go through that type of transition so quickly.
But meanwhile, I mean, these experiences are still happening. Tell me about the actual abduction.
Well, I actually don't have memory of abduction. I do have slight bits and pieces, you know, flashes in the mind of seeing different lights with my eyes barely perched open. But what I can tell you is I was in extreme denial. I was talking to my investigator. He said, "You're not going to like this, but I believe you have been abducted." And I couldn't accept that. You know, what rational mind can say, you know, a UFO came over my house, took me and my children and did experiments. I mean, that's just, you can't digest that right away. And it's taken me years to digest it as well. But what I couldn't overlook was the marks. I believe the first time is when I woke up and here I am on my couch. I have a .380 under my pillow, because if anything was going to come through that front door, I'm going to shoot it. You know, I was at that point. I was scared. I was confused. And he's pouring cereal, and I look up at him, and he's got this mark cut out of his forehead. And it was a large piece of skin. You know, it was pretty good sized. So I got up and I looked at it. I rushed him into the bathroom. And I'm putting peroxide on it and cold water. And I'm asking him, "How did you hit your head? What happened to you?" And he said, "I don't know, Dad. I just woke up and it's here." And he said, "Dad, look at your head." And he looks up in the mirror at me and points. And I looked up at my head and I had a gash in the same spot of my forehead. So I told my son, I said, "Hold on to the counter. Don't move." You know, and I went into his sister's room, pulled over the blanket, and there it was on her head as well. The same exact spot. Now, am I to believe that all three of us slept walk? Fell into an object of the same shape and size, with different weight distributions. All of us had the same depth and everything like that, all in one night. Well, that right there is an insane thought. There was about 3 days later, I woke up to my daughter screaming. I ran into her room as fast as I could, and she had her mouth just wide open, trying to scream. And I just ran up to her. I'm shaking her. "What's wrong? What's wrong?" And she pulls the blanket off of her shoulder. And from her shoulder cuff to her elbow were literally hundreds of scoops. And I'm not talking bug bites. You know, these things were deep enough to put a drop of water at least in each one of them. And I stopped counting on one arm at 174 on one arm. That's how ate up her arm was.
Oh, dear.
But as I'm freaking out, she, you know, she's got her mouth open. She's trying to say something to me, but she points at my arm, and I look down and I have the same thing. So, you know, I've known their pediatrician for 15 years. We've been golfing. He's a great guy. And he looks at her and says, "Good Lord, little girl, what in the world is eating you?" And he looks at me and he says, "Eric, these lesions are deep enough to be bleeding or at least pussing." He said, "The skin is so dehydrated that they're not doing either." You know, he said, "I've got to have some kind of explanation." He said, "Eric, if I haven't known you as long as I've known you, I'd have to report this." And I said, "What do you mean report this?" And he said, "Well, to DHS, you know, for harming your children or having your children in harm's way." You know, and I told him, I said, "Look, it's got to be some kind of bug bite or something. You know, I don't know." And he said, "Yeah, but that wouldn't explain the dehydration and things of that nature." So it was a terrible, terrible time to really be in a cognitive dissonance of what's going on, what's causing these things. And there were several different ones. I had woken up one morning, jumped in the shower, and as soon as the water hit my stomach, I felt a severe burning sensation. And I looked down, and from nipple to navel, a very long, long, what looks like a laser incision. And I've had a couple of doctors tell me that's exactly what a laser incision looks like. I have no idea where it came from, you know, but it's still there to this day, you know, just a big, long scar. So, you know, in the beginning, it was impossible to believe, but at the same time, where are these marks coming from? I'm not the type to jump out of bed and look at a tiny little nick on me and say, "Oh, that must be, you know, aliens." It's got to be something very substantial for me to even go that route. But I had to start looking into it.
And did your children have any memory? Do they now have any memory of these experiences?
Yes, they do. They do more than I do. They remember being on the craft. They remember me just being on a table and being incoherent. You know, they would say "Dad" or something like that, and I just wouldn't respond. At one point, my daughter remembers holding one of their hands and walking down a hallway and going into a room and trying this machine. And when she tried this machine, it seemed to put her directly into a meditative state of the way she described it, she said she felt like she was everything all at once. And she had a lot of trouble explaining that to me. But they have a lot more memory of abduction than I do. You know, most of my memory is right there in the front yard, you know, with this object.
We're coming up on a break here, but just in the few minutes before we break, just let's start this conversation about frequencies that were used, I guess, to communicate with you, and then we'll discuss how you sort of have this ability, or your brain has this ability to create sound. When did this all begin?
Sure. That happened when I got knocked down by the object. I usually don't talk about it too much, but I guess I don't mind. When this object knocked me down, I did feel it predominantly in my brain. Like I said before, we don't have nerve endings in our brain, but of course we can definitely have a headache once in a while. The next morning when I woke up covered in blood, covered in vomit. I was fully clothed. I kicked off my shoes and I got directly into the shower and just laid there fully clothed until the water, hot water ran out. I dried up, you know, I got on fresh clothes and I went in to get something to drink because I was insanely thirsty. I mean, I grabbed the cranberry juice and I didn't care. I was just spilling it down my shirt, just trying to get enough liquids into my body. And I started to walk from the kitchen into the living room, and I felt that slight rumble on the top of my head. So I literally grabbed the counter and braced. I froze. You know, you ever see a goat that gets scared, they just freeze and they fall over. I mean, that's the kind of terror that I was in at the moment. And as soon as I would kind of relax, that frequency and the vibration would just kind of go away. So about five times into it that morning, I kind of thought to myself, is this me? You know, am I doing this? So I paid attention to that that feeling. It felt like the center of my brain, like there's a little muscle in there.
Eric, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to we're going to head into a break, and we'll pick up on this on the other side. Eric Mitchell with a remarkable, harrowing almost horrifying abduction experience. Back with more of The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Don't go away. So, Eric, you were talking about the sensation in the top of your head, and it was happening over and over and over again. You want to pick up from where we left off there?
Well, sure. I kind of paid attention to where it was. You know, it felt like a muscle. You could move your finger, you could move your toes, and it just, I felt something in the center of my brain. So it's hard to explain, but I accessed it or allowed it. It's really difficult to articulate, but as soon as I did that, it went off. And I mean, went off bad. And I jumped up off the couch and I'm pacing back and forth and I'm going, oh my God, I'm insane. You know, I probably have schizophrenia or I have, you know, I keep wanting to lean toward that, especially in the beginning when all this was happening. But, you know, maybe I had a brain tumor. So I just totally freaked out. And I wasn't in a good position to experience that in the first place because I'd gone through so much already. So I got a hold of my investigator and I said, look, you're not going to believe this. I don't even want to tell you, but this is what's going on. And he said, let me send someone down there immediately and let's check it out. So he sent one of his investigators out. Nice lady. She came out. She witnessed the high strangeness, the lights flickering, the television turning on and off. She went through four cameras trying to film me on tape. I think she got 19 witnesses that day, but she, you know, poor thing, you know, she would plug in a camera, aim it, and it would just drain. So she went through four cameras. The fourth one, she just kept plugged into the wall so she can actually do the interviews. Well, she had told me, she said, we're going to be on camera and you can show me this vibration and frequency thing that you're talking about. And kind of, she looked really skeptical. You know, looking back, I don't blame her. I would be skeptical too. But I was shy about it, and I immediately got upset with her, thinking, you know, it doesn't believe me, you know. So I really got to push that out and show her. So I sat in a chair in front of mine, in front of the camera, and I leaned forward, and I put my forehead to her forehead, and I pushed it out as hard as I could. And she immediately fell out of the chair. I had to catch her. And her face swelled up and her eyes swelled shut and everything like that. So she had a lot to report to my investigator about it. You know, she said, this is a real thing. It's definitely not tinnitus or schizophrenia or anything like that, which we've gone through a lot of studying about it, you know, trying to figure out.
Right. I mean, what you're describing is not physiologically possible.
Right. That's what my doctor said. He did his thesis on the human brain in school, and he said there's nothing in the human brain that can create sound. Now, I have a friend of mine. Well, he's now a friend because of our dealings, but he worked for MIT for quite a while. And he postulates that I'm somehow able to push the subtle energy, you know, the firing between neurons, that it looks like electricity, but it's not. But he postulates that I'm able to somehow access all of it at once and push it to make sound vibration.
Is it measurable?
Well, I can set off EMP meters and stuff like that at will.
Do you remember that renowned debunker, the amazing Randy? He used to be a magician, and then he worked for one of these. Well, he's got an organization. He debunks this kind of stuff, and he offered up a prize of $1 million for anyone who could prove some sort of paranormal, supernatural phenomena. I mean, what you're describing, I think there's a check with your name on it for $1 million.
Well, I mean, if he would like to have coffee sometime, I'd love to show him. You know, this is not something that I can only do on the second Tuesday of every month. You know, this is something that, is with me all the time. I mean, I just entertain myself. I put in earphones and add to the music. Now, something very interesting that I've come across recently is Kit Green from the CIA. He works in Princeton University. He deals with DNA a lot. He's been scanning experiencers like myself, and he's been doing MRIs and stuff like that. And he got a hold of, I believe, who was that? Grant Cameron that's been talking to him.
Oh, yes. Canadian. And I know Grant. Yes.
Grant, great guy. Great researcher. I mean, if you want to follow the truth, he's always nipping the heels of it. So I talked to Grant recently, and Grant told me, he said, yeah, some of these guys are pushing out, not at will. Okay, these are brain scans. Of 25 hertz, 45 hertz, 50 hertz. And then he wanted to surprise me. And he said, Eric, some of these monks that they're scanning that meditate all the time, they're actually pulling out 100 hertz from their brain. And I kind of chuckled and I went, oh, no. Because last time I was sent to Nashville, now 100 hertz is below human hearing. You're not going to pick that up, but you're going to see it on screen, you know, with these computers. For me, it was 1,540 hertz in Nashville with a cheap shirt mic
dear
to
Lord.
My forehead.
Listen, we're gonna stop there. I'm just sorry. We'll take another quick time out. And a few minutes remain with Eric Mitchell and this remarkable, remarkable story. How could you go away? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.